I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Cohen. Joel Meyerowitz writes in his new book of photographs that the 9 months he spent working at Ground Zero in New York were the most rewarding of his life. He says he came as an outsider and was accepted as a member of the tribe. Joel Meyerowitz is an award-winning photographer and talked his way into documenting the recovery efforts at the site of the World Trade Center. The tribe was the construction workers, iron workers, demolition experts, bulldozer operators, firefighters, engineers, crane operators, police officers, volunteers, and others who worked tirelessly, many of them pouring through the tons of rubble looking for human remains, human artifacts, and assisting in the cleanup. Meyerowitz was the only photographer given unfettered access to the area, and he says he took the photographs for everyone who couldn't be there. He was there for 9 months and photographed during the day and night using a large format camera. The book is called Aftermath, the World Trade Center Archive, and it includes 400 heartbreakingly beautiful color photographs. The archive is part of a permanent collection of the Museum of the City of New York. Joel Meyerowitz is the author of 14 books of photography, including Cape Light, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. A great pleasure. Nice to have you with us. Good morning.
Good morning, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. You know, as we come up to this fifth anniversary of September 11th, I think everyone is sort of reliving where they were when they learned the news of what happened in New York at the World Trade Center, and then, of course, later at the Pentagon and later in western Pennsylvania. You were actually on Cape Cod when the World Trade Center was hit.
Yes, early in the morning. I was out photographing near Chatham, and it was that spectacularly clear and innocent day, and that innocence was shattered for all of us and certainly has affected us. And I got a call on my cell phone. My wife said, quick, get to a television set someplace. Something terrible has happened. And I managed to find my way to a motel nearby and watch as the second tower was struck and then as the buildings collapsed. And I immediately packed up the gear of that day and went back to my home in Provincetown and then tried to get back to New York only to find out no entry had been closed.
Were there certain images of that day, and I ask you that because you are a photographer, but are certain kinds of images that really have stayed with you from what happened in New York?
Well, watching what we all saw, seeing people holding hands and stepping out into the void, seeing the pancaking of the building, the 10-second slide of that structure whose initial construction I witnessed and whose top I had been upon numerous times, to see that all just give way in 10 seconds, the time span of it was what was so shocking to me, to see all that stuff, the paper and the metal flying out of the cloud. So yeah, a few of those moments of collapse were searingly deep in my mind.
I'm interested that you mentioned, people jumping out of the building, because that was something I remember I was wrestling with at the time, which is, you know, how do you make a decision like that? What would prompt someone to jump out of a building that obviously was on fire and in imminent collapse? But just the decision that you have to make to end your life.
I'm sure all of us reckoned with that decision ourselves, just as you're suggesting. And for me, I tried to imagine what 2,000 degrees was like behind me in the office and the clarity of the day outside. And who wouldn't make that decision? Mm. You have no way to turn, basically.
Exactly.
And you have a moment of freedom, perhaps. I mean, it's hard to say that because it's the last moment of freedom, but, you know, they had no way to turn.
How soon after then, September 11th, were you able to get back into the city and actually get back down, get and look at this site for the first time?
About 5 days later, they had opened the city, especially to people who lived below 14th Street, where I did. I lived within walking distance of the towers, I mean, maybe a 15-minute walk. So my wife and I came back and put our gear in the house, and the next morning, I took a walk down to the site just to get a sense of what I could see. And it was at that point that my life changed. And I had one of those experiences that differentiate who you were before and who you'll become after. And it's a lesson about how slight the change is that makes you a different person. I was standing in a crowd of onlookers at Chambers in Greenwich Street, which is about four blocks north of where the North Tower stood. And there was literally nothing to see in the immediate foreground. It had been closed off with cyclone fencing and covered with tarpaulins everywhere. And I just stood in the crowd and I did the most innocent thing, something I think is innocent. I've been doing it all my life. I picked up my Leica and I just sort of looked through it to see what a framed image of the world looks like. No sooner did I do this than from behind me, I was struck on my shoulder by a pointy finger jabbing at me. And I turned around and there was a woman cop who said to me, "Hey, buddy, no photographs here. This is a crime scene." You know, it was shocking. I was just standing on the street. And so as a New Yorker with a license to say anything, I said to her, "Hey, wait a second. We're standing on a public thoroughfare. Don't tell me I can't take a picture here. The crime scene is in there." She came back with immediately saying, "I'm taking that camera away. You give me any lip, Buster." I said, "Hold on. Suppose I was the press. How about that?" And she said, "Well, the press is back there. Take a look for yourself." And there was the press corps, half a block away, surrounded by yellow police tape, and obviously not going anywhere. And I said, "When are they going in?" And her response was, "Never. This is a crime scene. No photography allowed."
And is that the moment you decided that you were going to get inside this crime scene and begin to photograph?
It produced the moment, because it took me really a few minutes to understand that no photography actually meant no history. And who were these people who were saying no photography? It was the mayor and the police commissioner, but why? And as I walked past the press corps, I had this sense of, without history, we're poor for all of the efforts that are going to be made in there. We need something. And it occurred to me then, that's what I could do, because I had been yearning to help. You know, writing a check is important, but it doesn't sustain you in terms of really wanting to help. And I'm a native New Yorker.
And helping meant photographing, documenting what was inside this rubble.
Ultimately, that's what I saw. When I realized that their no meant I needed to do something about this, that I could make an archive, that gave me the kind of sense of, I can be of help, and I'm going to figure out a way to do this.
Well, what's interesting is you had, you know, some moderate connections, I guess, with the local government, but you also just seemed totally determined to be there, and I guess a certain amount of luck. You befriended some cops, or I guess they were detectives, who you stumbled across. They were sitting in some chairs, and they looks like they sort of adopted you in a way, and began to show you around the site and point out things that they had observed as they were there working.
Yes, they were my angels down there.
Is that right?
These guys, you know, I didn't befriend them. They befriended me.
Is that right?
I mean, every other cop.
You stumbled into them, I guess.
Every other cop was throwing me out. But these guys, because they were detectives and they thought things through in some way, when I came upon them and I dreaded it, when I saw the eight of them sitting where I knew I had to stand, I thought, oh, my God, they're all going to throw me out. When I got there, I sort of channeled my father, who was a natural comic, and I sat down on one of the detectives' laps, and I said, "Hey, you're in my spot." And they all jumped up and said, "Oh, excuse me, as if I was serious. And with that, they saw the camera. They asked some questions because they were curious. And when I said, "I'm doing this for history," they got it. They said, "Absolutely, we need this record." And I said, "Yeah, but the mayor's edict means every other cop down here is throwing me out." And they said, basically, "Screw the mayor. We need this
record." In New
York
fashion, right?
In New York fashion. They said, "We're going to protect you. You won't get thrown out anymore. Here's our phone numbers. If you're in trouble, just call us. We'll take care of you. And by the way, have you been up on the roof yet?" And they took me up to the World Financial Center and made what is now the cover of this book. And it allowed me to see the site in its entirety, late at night, all of it developing as it was.
And we should say that you use a big camera. It's a big format camera.
Yes, a large format wooden view camera built in 1946. You have to put plates in, not glass plates, they don't exist any longer, but I wanted to use this camera because I was hoping to make a record of great authority and authenticity that would give people who looked at the photographs a visceral feeling of what it was like to be standing there. I wasn't looking to make art.
But what's, and I want to pick up on that, but what's interesting is just this is a big camera. Most people these days are using, you know, their camera phone to document the world. You can't really sneak in and out of a crime scene, as this was called, with a big view camera. And I'm certain you had other things on your back that looked like photographer.
Mm-hmm. I was not hiding it. I was absolutely going against the edict, but I was doing it in the most forthright manner. And I did have a worker's badge that a friend was able to give to me, which I immediately duplicated on the computer, and I have to say, forged any time I needed to make other passes to try to bring in people from the world of feelings, museum directors and editors and people who I thought might be conscious enough to help get this site surveyed as I was trying to do it by a larger force than myself, which I actually petitioned Mayor Giuliani to do. I wrote a 4-page proposal saying, let me come in like the Farm Security Administration did the Depression photographs and come in with 6 other photographers so that we could be a unit that would make the record, probably 20,000 pictures, and give it to the Museum of the City of New York or other institutions to be there for the future. So I wanted to do this not for profit.
Well, speaking of the 1930s, it was really, I guess, and then the tradition of Dorothea Lange and Walker Evans, who documented the Depression in this country. Was that these were black and white photographs. Yours are in
right.
color. But those were the inspiration for you, these two people?
Well, more than them. Certainly Walker Evans primarily, but Russell Lee and countless others, because they were given a shooting script by a guy named Roy Stryker, who was appointed by President Roosevelt. And Roy Stryker wrote this shooting script about the Depression. And I read that script years ago, and I had certainly studied in the archives of the Library of Congress, and I've seen probably 10,000 of these pictures. I knew that their coverage was an incredibly comprehensive look at America and the way people lived. I was trying to take that same approach and squeeze it into 16 acres of destruction in Lower Manhattan and look at all of the way it impacted the life in Manhattan and the way the people who were doing the work inside were living. We needed to see this.
Let me just reintroduce you, and that's Joel Meyerowitz, our guest today on Radio Times, and he's talking about the 9 months that he spent inside the pile, as the World Trade Center in New York City came to be known. He was there for 9 months and watched as the workers sifted through the rubble. They cleared 9 million pounds of debris from the 16-acre site. He was able to take photographs, which are now in a brand new book, and it's called Aftermath. And you can check out a couple of those photographs at our website at whyy.org/radiotimes. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
WHYY presents David Sedaris, humorist and author, at Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall, Sunday, October 8th at 8 p.m. David Sedaris live for one performance only, 215-893-1999. Theater Council supports WHYY.
I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, it's fall planting time. I'll help you grow garlic for flavor, pansies for fall color and better-looking legs, and trees and shrubs that'll soar through next season, plus chemical-free answers to all your garden questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
It's not fair to want everything without having to do something for it.
It's not a question of technicality only. It's a question of what is morally right.
Is legalizing undocumented workers a civil rights issue? African Americans are split. I'm Ed Gordon, wrestling over the role of rights in the immigration debate next time on News and Notes from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY. Pembroke North, a new mainline condominium community of 54 single-level homes, supports WHYY. Sales office in Spread Eagle Village opens September 9th. For details, pembrokenorth.com or 610-687-3872.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking with acclaimed photographer Joel Meyerowitz. And we're talking about the 9 months he spent documenting the work at the World Trade Center. He was there for 9 months at Ground Zero while workers worked through all the rubble, got rid of all the rubble, and certainly found human remains and human artifacts. And he documents all of this in his new book. It's a great big book with great big glorious photographs, really, called Aftermath, World Trade Center Archive. And he used one of those big, large format cameras. I describe this as a kind of a terrible beauty, and I have to say, sort of looking through the photographs, when you think about what it is, it's just heartbreaking, of course, and it's mountains of rubble, and it's people working there, and you try to imagine what it must have been like to be inside that building as it fell down, imploded. But I wonder just how much you wanted to sort of be spontaneous in your photographing, or how much you work to frame things so that it fit a kind of a definition of what beautiful is.
It's a very difficult subject to grapple with, to be in a place like that. It was unlike any space I've ever been in. And certainly, I was trying to be a historian and really make information be visible. But, you know, you have a frame. All photographers put a frame around things, and when you put a frame around it, you try to put it in the frame in a way that is open-hearted and very telling so that the viewer can enter the space. If you tell people too much photographically, if you push your own point of view, then people only get a narrow message, and I felt there was much more here. Nonetheless, the horror of the event, the loss of life, the sense of being inside this cemetery provoked a kind of friction for me. Mm. I mean, how do you stand there on a beautiful fall day with the sky being blue with white puffy clouds and these incredible red-covered buildings, and you feel the sun on your back, and you think to yourself, it's good to be alive, and you suddenly think, oh, my God, I'm standing in this place with, and I have no right to feel this way, nor do I have any right to make aesthetic pleasure out of this.
But you did, right? There was aesthetic pleasure.
Where does it come from is the question. I mean, how do you make pictures? I mean, so many people have said these pictures are beautiful, and it always astonishes me to say that because, you know, it wasn't my doing. It was in and of itself exactly what you see, but nature has a hand in this. Mm. You know, nature is indifferent to this. Nature doesn't view a tragedy. Nature is nature. And so on a beautiful day, a horrible event happened, and other beautiful days came, and things were crowned with golden clouds or incredibly beautiful late afternoons. Things happen. But I think underlying it all was something special. In a place of great tragedy and of horrific complexity, one sees a need, or feels, I should say, the need for beauty. Beauty is the salve to your disrupted feelings. And I think probably I was succumbing to a sense of wanting to restore the world to some sense of order. And maybe that's where this little tincture of beauty appears. And so, yes, if some of these pictures have it, maybe it's a sense of me saying, optimism and hope are associated with beauty. Beauty is the ripening of the fruit, in a way.
I ran across a quote of yours that probably predates September 11th, where you said, I've never felt creative, but you described yourself and perhaps even your photography, but you said you felt responsive. And I think that's an interesting distinction. I don't know if you remember saying that or not.
I do.
But responsive is, in a way, is sort of opening up yourself to the world and feeling, experiencing what the world is feeling, which is, I think, different from creative.
It is. Photographers in general different from painters. A painter takes a blank tabula rasa and puts marks on it, let's say, and builds it up out of experience. Photographers press a button, and you have a thousandth of a second to respond to something that you witness. Now, that witnessing may connect to something deep inside of you. In fact, at your best, if you're consistent, you produce a body of work that's about these responses. But it's also an affirmation. For me, pressing the button is yes. Yes, that's important. Yes, that's me out there. So I've learned to respond or to stay open to the suggestibility of things so that I can keep unfolding as an artist and as a human being, basically.
Did your photographs ever surprise you, though, once you printed what you had taken in that millisecond? Did you see things that you hadn't seen when you looked through the lens?
Yeah, it's that, you know, photography is a rich discipline in the sense that you have an immediate moment to respond in, and you try to see and feel as much as you can in that split second. But afterwards, you realize the camera has gathered even more subtlety than you could take in. But you learn to read that, and that hopefully makes you a more observant artist and makes you comprehend in a flash what's actually out there. So I think I am responsible for everything in that frame.
You say, and this really struck me, is that what survived were steel and paper. It's like the heaviest and the lightest survived the attacks on the World Trade Center.
An amazing dichotomy.
Yes.
Really, because in the cloud, all of that dust was the result of the concrete being pulverized and sent out as this smoky dust. So down in the site was this catastrophe of steel, everything sharp, hard-edged, cables and steel and plumbing and wiring, and you rarely saw anything like rocks and pebbles. Later on, down at the very bottom, some of that stuff survived. But throughout the debris, it was mostly papers and journals and notebooks and accountant ledgers, things like that, and steel.
I'm thinking, though, about the sort of artifacts, you know, the things that people bring to work, you know, what they put on their desks, the notes that they scribble. You saw that littered around. I mean, the artifacts that people just gather around them when they're at work.
It's hard to say it was funny, but it was funny, because to walk in some of the buildings that survived and to see the mess, you know the expression, my desk is a mess?
Yes.
Well, it was in more ways than is imaginable. But I would see desks in these dark corridors that I was walking through, and there would be the Smurf on the pencil. I think, didn't Smurfs go out in the 80s? And funny little plaques and the loving cups and things, the trophies out there, and all the stuff of offices. But they take on a very different meaning, a sort of Pompeii-like meaning, when you see them in a disaster like this, because you realize they represent the 21st century. This is what an office looked like in the 21st century. If you could have removed that in its dust-covered state and put it in a vitrine in a natural history museum, it would be remarkable to see this is what business looks like.
But this is also what happens when time stops. I mean, don't you also get, it's almost like a photograph in time when people had to flee a building, they left everything behind, the dust settles. As you say, it looks like Pompeii. Mm. I've been to Pompeii, and you do feel as if time has stopped there.
Right. The whole thing becomes the time capsule.
Right.
Rather than people taking a capsule and putting things into it, it is the time capsule. And I can't tell you how many days I would call the curators at the Museum of the City of New York and say, I've just found something. You must come down here and take this away. It will be the most remarkable exhibit. And they never came. I mean, I saw things because the concrete dust had been blown everywhere, into every corner, and with it, all of these artifacts that tumbled around, water bottles and papers and Venetian blinds and things like that. And then, over time, with moisture in the air or rain, the concrete dust hardened, and things were embedded in a movable way. You could literally slide out an entire corner of a room, and it was solid. And those things should have been carted away, slipped with something underneath it, a sheet, piece of sheet metal or something like that, and lifted up whole. But they weren't. You know? And so we don't have those artifacts to look at and say, this is what it looked like.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Joel Marowitz, our guest today on Radio Times. He's an acclaimed award-winning photographer, and he's got a new book out called Aftermath, World Trade Center Archive. He spent 9 months at Ground Zero with all the workers there, photographing the buildings and what was left of them, photographing the many workers on the site, including construction workers and iron workers and bulldozer operators, firefighters, engineers, crane operators. And he joins this morning on Radio Times to talk about his experiences and to talk about what he photographed. You can also look at some of those photographs at our website at whyy.org/Radio Times. We learned recently from some health reports that a majority of the workers down there at the World Trade Center have some pretty serious health problems, including lung problems. Do you think you were affected at all, having spent 9 months down there?
I have a physical every year, but I do have, you could hear it in my voice, a slight reedy quality. And I don't know if that was exacerbated by that event down there. I did wear a respirator, but you can't stay in the respirator 12, 14 hours a day. I had to get out sometimes and just breathe what seemed like fresh air. And although they were monitoring the air conditions regularly down there and posting them, we don't know how accurate that was and whether the toxins and asbestos fibers that were in there had done their damage. I know a number of men who have respiratory problems and others who have bleeding ulcers and others who have throat cancer and stuff like that. And, you know, was it because they were smokers beforehand or was it because they were in this dust for the first 50 days or so when it was at its worst? And, you know, everybody feels young and strong and they're going to live forever, and they do foolish things. And it was only later when members of OSHA came around and said, you got to put that mask on or you're out of here. And so they
laid down the law then.
They were very strict. They laid down the law. I mean, I can't tell you how many times they came to me and said, put those goggles on. Because they didn't want, you know, things to like come popping up out of the pile and you sue them for eye damage or something like that. City property.
There were bodies in this rubble. I think something like 19,000 body parts were found.
Yes.
Did you see things like that? Did you see body parts as you walked the area?
I did. I chose, thinking discretion was the right approach, not to photograph too closely the finding of remains. I think that the members of the fire department were extremely sensitive about the dead, their dead in particular, being in any way sensationalized in the media. And although I was doing this not for profit and I wasn't publishing this in the, you know, regular media, I was discreet. However, I did photograph the rituals, and these rituals are important to describe because they are a focus. Ground Zero was about recovery. If they weren't doing the recovery, they would have cleaned that place out in 2 months. That's what Charlie Vitchers, who ran the site, and the head superintendent said. This place could be moved in 2 months. But it took 9 months because every square foot of ground on every level was sifted looking for remains. So if remains were found, they were put on a little sort of a little orange skid or a stretcher, a Stokes basket it was called, and then they were covered with American flag, and an honor guard was formed, and people would walk it up out of the pit into the first layer, and then it would go into an ambulance and be taken away for forensic studies. However, there's an interesting distinction I'd like to share
everybody. Go ahead.
The uniformed services down there perform like the military, in a sense. So they always form this honor guard and a flag. But if a civilian was found, they were put usually in a body bag. So the call went out usually, bag or flag. Now, you know, that makes a distinction that was a little bit difficult for people to take. And one day, a woman named Pia Hoffman, who was the only licensed crane operator and bulldozer operator down there, was on a grappler, and she made a find. And it was the body of a woman. And she called for someone to come over to take the remains away. And the guy yelled out, "Bring a bag." And she was incensed. And she put her claw down over the body, and she said, "No, go get a flag. And this body is not leaving here until it's in a stretcher with a flag covering it and an honor guard." And she set down the law, and she changed the site. And I am happy to say, as a woman I know and who is an incredibly courageous person, who stuck to her guns and was able to alter this process.
So. Well, that's just an amazingly moving story. But and it also just underscores, because these were private rituals. I mean, this was not there for the press or for anybody. These were rituals done by the workers themselves. Do you think for themselves as much as for the dead?
Absolutely. I mean, there was no press in there to see the to use it in a publicly stated way. This was one of those rituals that comes with the site and becomes embedded in a daily way. And it happened, can I say, 20 times a day? Probably more. The site was divided into four quadrants, and this was happening all over the site in little pockets. So there were always men stopping the action. The body was, you know, exhumed, put on the skid, taken out, and usually there'd be six or eight firemen stopping, holding on to the Stokes basket and carrying it up at a slow dirge pace. You know, for who?
Hmm.
Only for the dead.
And perhaps themselves.
Well, for themselves, certainly.
Right.
But the fact that they gave this respect to the dead, is it left us always in tears.
Was there a lot of crying going on at the Ground Zero?
Unexpected. You know, these were big, tough guys in a way, both the firefighters as well as the construction workers. But I cannot tell you how frequently, probably every time I was down there, that somebody would come and tell me, because, you know, I became sort of the resident eye, and people understood I was the historian. So they'd come to me and say, you know, so-and-so found his son, carried his son out. And then maybe I'd meet the father, and he would tell me, I carried Tommy out in my arms. You know, you stand there and you're heartbroken.
Mm.
And other times, just people would, I mean, a guy once handed me a Bible. He was digging out of the South Tower, and he came upon a Bible which had been welded by heat to a piece of steel. And then it had fallen. Maybe it was in someone's drawer, you know, and the vinyl cover melted. And then it was shredded and burned and soaked and then covered in dust and then buried. And this guy dug it out and he handed me this Bible. He said, "Hey, I think you should have this. It's about 8 pounds, like weighs like my book weighs." And the Bible was open to a page which was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth.
Wow.
The page. And he handed me this artifact, which ultimately I'll give to the Memorial Museum down there, because I think it's one of those things you need.
Indeed. And that's Joel Marowitz, our guest today on Radio Times. And we're talking about the 9 months that he spent at Ground Zero documenting the recovery efforts there. That's the subject of his new book, and it's called Aftermath, World Trade Center Archive. We'll be right back. Let me just add, though, that we have put some of his photographs on our website at whyy.org/Radio Times. We'll be right back.
The FCC has tightened its restrictions on indecency and raised the fines tenfold. Many broadcasters say this is having a chilling effect, forcing them to practice self-censorship. On the next Fresh Air, we'll discuss this with several guests, including FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Next time on Day to Day...
The New Orleans Saints play for love, profit, and, well, because there's a line item for it in the Louisiana budget.
Now, some fans are calling for a new game plan.
I don't mind my tax dollars going there to keep them there, personally. I can think of other things that it's squandered on throughout our state.
Tackling state subsidies in a post-Katrina world next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. It's been 5 years. When disaster, man-made or natural, strikes, what do you do? Do your children know what to do? Also, is Star Trek really 40 years old? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Coaim. After September 11th, Ground Zero was classified as a crime scene, but with the help of a number of city officials and his own pushiness, the photographer Joel Myritz turned out to be the only photographer granted unlimited access to the site. For 9 months, he photographed day and night, and his photographs are included in a brand new book, and it's called Aftermath, World Trade Center Archive, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. We have put a couple of his photographs on our website that you can look at WHYY.org/Radio Times. The stories of the men and women that you got to know working in the World Trade Center site at Ground Zero are really they're just wonderfully moving. And there's a guy here named Eddie, a mechanic. You have a wonderful photograph of him standing before a great big, some kind of a truck or backhoe of some sort, huge. He's standing there. He's got tattoos. His hat is on askew. He's got sunglasses, a big jackhammer or something over his shoulders. He looks dirty. And he's got a great expression on his face, kind of not exactly a snarl, but he's looking at you like a tough guy.
You got to think that's his smile.
That is smile.
Also, he has his jewelry on, if you notice.
Oh, you're right. Yes, exactly. Nice necklace on as well.
He was a real New York character, just out of jail, 3 days. And I said, how'd you get a job in Ground Zero so fast? He says, hey,
this is his voice, right?
I got family. Yeah, he must have screamed his entire life because his voice was always down here like this. Here. And he was funny and bright and dangerous. And I made this picture of him.
Yeah, it's a great picture, too.
And it ran in the New Yorker. And he was not a regular reader of the New Yorker, I would say, but he bought up all the copies. And the next time I saw him on the site, he was excited and happy. And he came over to me. He's like, Jolie boy, so I'm a made man in my neighborhood now. Even my mother loves me now. Anyway, at some point, he said to me, listen, anything I can do for you, I can do it. Don't worry. He said, I do slice and dice. You know what I mean? He said, you want to get rid of your old lady? He says, a little bit of lime, some roses. I take care of it. Don't worry. I'm with you. I said, thanks, Eddie. Yeah, very much. I mean, that's very kind of you. I don't think I'll be needing slice and dice, actually. But you met characters down there. And it was filled with everything, profanity and humor and tragedy and poetry. It was life itself. And I tried to do something in the book. If I could just take a moment here. A book has to have some kind of arc and have fulfillment at the end. You want to feel that sense of accomplishing, understanding what you saw. But this site started so dramatically, and by the time it came to an end 9 months later, it was an empty hole in the ground. How do I make that interesting, I thought. And what I understood was that in the beginning, I couldn't really photograph the people. They were like ants on the pile, tiny and far away, and people didn't have time to stop to have their picture taken. It was too important to do the work. But by the end, when the work was slowing down, the people came forward. The humanity of the site came forward. And I began to see who were these people who stayed the course, who did the work, who were there for us, who did that incredible spiritual recovery work for us. And so I filled the book with people at the end because I wanted to say, we did this for the families. These people did this for the family members. They brought this thing to a conclusion. They found the bodies. And I think it's important that we identify at least 50 or so people to stand in for everybody else.
You have a scene, it's one of the last photographs in the book, of a man by himself looking through the dirt. They were rakers, and part of their job was just to rake through the debris looking for, I guess, human remains or anything that would help understand what happened there. And it's near the very end of the this whole process, and he's on his hands and knees and looking at something very carefully, right. Very intently.
It was just about the last evening before they closed the site. And, you know, the rakers were the most consistent image in Ground Zero, because it was almost a historic, ancient image. Somebody standing with a rake going through some rubble like the earth. And in this case, he was on his hands and knees hours before closing, still looking at his square foot of ground, trying to determine, is this a pebble or a bone? And to observe him doing this, he could have gotten up. It was time to go, you know. He had seen it. He had looked through everything already. And yet, in the last bit of light of day, this guy was there doing it. And I thought, this is a picture of devotion on his knees. And that's how it went day after day. And there was a man down there named Tooley O'Toole, a fireman. And one day, I was photographing one of these raking fields where they dumped the bottom of the pit rubble for a last go-through and sifting. And I was just trying to photograph the emptiness of this patch of rubble. And he walked across it and picked up a rake and raked his way out. And I stopped him. I went around. I said, how come? Your shift is over. Why aren't you just going home? And he said, I don't know. It's just what we do. He said, we're down here doing it. And I said, but, you know, it's such an ancient gesture. I said, you're in there like farmers. He said, no. He said, we're gardeners in the garden of the dead. Huh. And I thought, you know, this guy just came out with it, which means he thought about this. He's seen himself and all of them gardening through this rubble. And I thought, it's unfair of us to ever prejudge someone as if they're, you know, they're construction worker, they're not going to have these thoughts. These guys are filled with open-heartedness and poetry and passion and humor. And I learned, being 8-9 months in there with these guys, I connected to men and women who in the ordinary course of my life as an artist I don't cross with, but that was an incredibly special time, and I have friends that...
Well, I was wondering about that, whether you have made friends or whether you're still in contact with the people that you spent 9 months with down there.
On Monday, 9/11, there'll be an event at the New York Public Library where we're launching the book, and there'll be at least 100 men and women from Ground Zero who are coming back, all friends of mine, who are coming to sort of share this moment with us, and also to be recognized by New York City as people who did the hard and difficult work.
Is it still shocking to you to look at the New York skyline without the World Trade Center? And your book actually begins with some photographs taken well before September 11th, I guess maybe even out your window looking at the skyline, and there are those two towers. Yeah. Have you gotten used to the city not having the towers?
No, I'm not used to it. And I think most people... If you go to the site, you will see the tourists standing there pointing upwards at emptiness. They point to the void as if they could see in some way where the top used to be. And it is there. It's a vacancy. And I think that the memorial will actually point out the meaning of absence, which I think is an important consideration, because there will be buildings built around the perimeter, but not on those sort of sacred sites right now. And yeah, I feel it. I come down the West Side Highway and they're not there.
Right. And it still seems strange and awful.
It's eerie to feel. And of course, my connection to it is so strong now that I near the zone and I suddenly start getting memory jolts, which are unpredictable and involuntary. You know, it's like suddenly I'm a little bit disturbed by those feelings again, because I'm carrying the library of images in my head. You know?
You mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that you were changed by this. Is that how you're changed? Is that the images that you now have in your head are ones that weren't there before you began this project?
Well, that's an effect of having made all of the images, and I have a sort of photographic memory. No, but the change is different. I could say I think I'm changed in two ways. One is that as a citizen, I actually acted out on this impulse to make an archive. I fought the bureaucracy, which was basically saying, no, we don't want you, we don't need it, it's canceled. And I stood up for the first time since Vietnam, basically, as a citizen and said, no, goddammit, I'm going to do this because we need to do this and we need to have it afterwards. And so I think beyond our vote, we as citizens have a right to make our voices heard. And certainly in the political climate of today, with an administration such as we have, we need to have our voice felt. And I urge all of us to remember that as citizens, we have that right of free speech. And secondly, I think I was changed as in the sense that I wanted to do something to be useful because I felt useless and helpless. And now I find that as an artist, I'm turning to doing things that have utility, social utility, in a more regular way. I'm currently involved in a big project in New York that has a purely social and historical function, and that's photographing all the parks of New York City, 29,000 acres, to kind of make a record.
There was a place, as you write in this book, that you went back to time and time again and have one of these beautiful photographs of the Winter Garden. It's in, near collapse here. But you can still see some of the structures of the Winter Garden there and clearly sort of the skeleton of what was that building there. And it's a place that you kept coming back to. Why?
Yes, well... Before 9/11, it's a place that I would often go to see dance concerts, on a Sunday, or see the orchid show, or listen to music, have a cup of tea. A great open public space in New York with a domed roof like the Baths of Caracalla. So it had elegance and power. And then it was crushed this way, and to see it raked by that golden light was to have it become animate again. The soul of the building was visible in some way, and now it's been completely restored. And it's one of those strange New York spaces where, although it's in a corporate office center, it's a place where the nannies and the mothers who take care of their children in Battery Park City bring their kids to play. So it's a mixture of guys in business suits and kids sort of playing on these marble surfaces where the echoes of their little voices play among the palm trees. So it's a gilded cage for these beautiful little bambini who are everywhere. And, joggers are coming through, guys in business suits. It's an incredible human mix, and it's wonderful to see it come back to life.
What were the sounds in Ground Zero? As you mentioned, the sounds of children playing as you were there and they were doing the recovery.
Ground Zero was a nightmare of sounds. There were 72 gigantic grapplers in there, which removed debris at a furious rate. And there were enormous cranes and hundreds of trucks and the sounds of jackhammers and machines cutting and burning. So it was a cacophony of sound that it was hard to hear yourself talking to people. I mean, that's how noisy it was. And now... Actually, the sound has returned. But in the last few pictures in the book were days I went down in June of 2002, and it was...
Just the wind going through.
Just summer wind and a kind of haunting, hollow sound, no sound of work whatsoever. To be in that space like that was a kind of surreal and awesome experience. And now it's begun again. They started building the new buildings, and the foundations are being protected. All of it is happening. It's exciting, actually.
Do you miss being there? I mean, it must have been difficult because clearly it was such a tragic part of New York to be in, but also full of life.
Something happened along about March and April that was astonishing to experience. Workers, seeing the end approaching, started to feel and express a nostalgia for the beginning. Not that they wanted the horror to happen again, but when they came in to do the work, there was a cause, and they were beginning to become part of this larger army of workers. And I think all of us felt that comradeship And, you know, there's something beautiful about the human endeavor when you do something together, you take this task on, and they were missing, and I was too, to tell you the truth. They were beginning to miss this comradeship, and soon they would go back and they would be building shopping malls, apartment houses. It wouldn't have the connection to something necessary. And so the cause mentality was dissipating, and I think people were fearful. And there was one guy, there's a picture of a fireman in there, a chief, and he said to me, "You know, I'm really worried about these guys. They're going to go out there and they're all going to start drinking hard." And it was his way of saying that the loss of the reason for being was going to be shocking to people after this time. And sure.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but you do talk about the American can-do spirit. And certainly that has been a cliche, but it seems as if you saw that at work at Ground Zero.
It was tangible and visible and something that we take for granted now. You know, we can build or do anything, but this can-do had heart to it. People gave of themselves. They brought to it an ephemeral quality that is spirituality, and you can't finger it. You know, it's not a commodity, but the devotion of the workers, the way they helped each other, the care with which they looked for the remains, the sense of the unity brought this thing to the cathedral space that was there. You know, these were called shrouds, the remaining frames of the building. And the amphitheater-like quality of the whole space, contained in 16 acres, gave to it this spiritual dimension, which was fulfilled by the people who brought themselves there.
Joel Meyerowitz, a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, and thank you so much for doing this book as well.
You're welcome, Marty.
We have been talking with Joel Meyerowitz, and his book is called Aftermath, World Trade Center Archive. Deborah Lissick, Alan Tu, Susan Greenbaum produce Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Leave us an email and look at some of Joel Meyerowitz's photographs. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to WHYY FM Philadelphia, serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, and worldwide at whyy.org.